Could you tell us a little bit about the history of the church?
Yes. I think we need to really start in Germany in about 1776, I think it was. Catherine the Great offered free land to people in Russia if they would come there and settle it. She wanted the Volga area settled because there wasn't anybody there to farm the land or to make it productive for her, so she offered free land, and they would be exempt from taxes and from military service if they would come there and settle. And some of the people in Germany were afraid that they would have to join the Kaiser's army and serve in the military, and they didn't want to do that. And so they accepted that offer and moved to Russia. And things went pretty well there for about 100 years, but after Catherine the Great was gone, the Russians decided that the young men would not be exempt from military service anymore, and they started to think that they would tax them. So as Katie was saying a while ago here, that they sent out some teams to see what life would be like in the United States and if they could find a place where they could practice their religion, which was highly important to them, without being afraid that they would be drafted into the army. They especially didn't like to be their young people drafted into the Russian army because they weren't allowed to practice a religion in the Russian army. They weren't allowed to take holy days off and go to mass whenever they wanted to and all of that. So it was important to them to, for religious reasons, to find a place where they would be able to practice their religion as they wanted to. The reports that came back from the United States were very favorable. They thought that they could grow their crops, especially the hard red winter wheat here in Kansas. They thought it would be favorable. And so they started sending parties over here to settle the land. And actually, where we're sitting now is Herzog. Mm-hmm. And that was the first name of this community of German Russians who settled here. They came in 1875. As they got as far as Topeka, they came by boat from Germany, and then they stayed the winter in Topeka because it was a rather hard winter and they didn't want to come out here with no housing or no way to survive on the plains. So in the spring of 1876, the group came out here to Victoria and settled. They first built dugouts close to the creek so they would have water, and later on they constructed some sod homes and some wooden houses. Timber was scarce here, so they kind of used the building materials that they had available, and they made use of the limestone, which is plentiful in the area, for fence posts and for housing and for buildings. So that's kind of the history of how the people got here.
Where are they?
Their religion was very important. This is Corey.
Okay.
I'll just stop here and introduce Corey to you.
Sorry, I'm late. But
that's all right. This is Corey Schulte, Jeff.
I'm Jeff Payton. Nice to meet
Jeff
you.
Payton.
She is our
student at KU.
Yes.
She is our historian here and our chairman of our history committee on our centennial.
But he's the one who knows everything, and she does.
No,
she does too.
And Katie and Corey can correct me when I make a mistake here.
The three of you, I think we have everybody we need.
Maybe more than you need.
No, this is great.
I'll continue with what I was saying here then. The religion was so important to the people here, and they, of course, didn't have a church here. There wasn't a Catholic priest available, but they erected a huge cross in the middle of the village, and they would gather under the cross and on holy days and Sundays and any time that they wanted to have a religious celebration, and they'd say the rosary and prayers, and that was had to do for a while. Then the bishop of this whole state at the time decided that the people should have access to a priest. So he contacted the Capuchins in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And they had some German-speaking priests there, and it was important that they be German-speaking because most of these people didn't understand any English, and some did understand very little, but they needed a German-speaking priest. And so the priests came out here from time to time, and they had their weddings and baptisms and the important ceremonies, and of course said mass and offered communion, and that was kind of on a hit and miss basis for a while, and finally they decided they needed some type of church, so they erected a lean-to church. It was beside the house of a gentleman named A.A. Dryling. And that church wasn't near large enough, and they had to be careful that they didn't get too many people in there at one time so they didn't fall through the floor of it. And they had that church, I think that church was erected about 1876. They built that church. And they realized they needed a bigger church, so they constructed a larger church then, which we call the second church now. And that church was constructed of stone, and it held, I think, around 200 people. And they still wasn't large enough because the community kept growing. People were more and more people were coming from Russia, and they were all Catholics, and they all wanted to be at every celebration. And so they decided, well, they needed a bigger church, and they raised some funds. One of the priests that was here contacted some friends in England, and a gentleman by the name of Maxwell was especially influenced in getting some funds from England. And then they got the Kansas Pacific Railroad at the time to donate 10 acres of land where our cathedral stands now. And they built a third church, and that one was built out of limestone. I understand that limestone was quarried pretty close to Victoria here along the creek, Big Creek here, and they constructed a church that seated 600 people, and they thought that should be large enough and take care of their needs for a while. But as time went on, that church became too small also, and they were having another problem. That limestone wasn't a very good construction material. It started to crack, and some engineers told them that that church wouldn't last more than probably another 30 years or so. And so they decided they needed maybe to build a church that would last a while, and that they wanted a beautiful house of God. And they wanted to be able to seat the entire congregation for any service that they wished to have. And with that in mind, in 1904, they decided to build a church and started hauling stone from 5 miles south and 2.5 miles east out by Vincent, Kansas, from a quarry out there. It was a harder limestone and was deposited in deposits about 8 inches thick. So that indicates the thickness of the blocks in the church there. And if you measure those, they're dressed to be 8 inches thick. The deposits aren't totally level, but they were about 8 inches thick. And so they decided that each communicant 12 years old and older would be assessed 6 loads of stone and $45 a year. And so they began to haul the stone in to where you see the church over here now, and they decided what they would do is tear down that third church and use the stone in it to build the interior walls and build the exterior walls out of the new limestone which they'd quarry. The quarrying process was quite interesting. They would go out and remove the overburden. I understand that from what I've studied that they used a horse-drawn scraper to remove some of the overburden. And when they got down to the limestone layer, they would mark off a block about 12 inches wide, and they would go out with a regular wood-type brace. Mm-hmm. And they used either a 5/8 or a 3/4 inch bit in that brace, which they modified out of a wood bit. and they would drill a hole about halfway through, maybe a little more than halfway. You can see it on all the blocks over there in the cathedral. They'd drill that down till they were about halfway through, and then the blacksmiths manufactured some devices known as feathers, which they'd insert in the hole, put a metal wedge between that in each of the holes they drilled. They drilled those holes about every 10 to 12 inches, mm-hmm. and then they'd go along there with their hammer and keep tapping those feathers and the wedges until that block split off. And then they would split it into a length that was manageable to haul in. They hauled that all in from Vincent by horse and wagon and stacked it out here on the lot ready for the construction, which they finally began then in the year of 1908. It took them about 4 years to get started on it. They had problems with the architect, and they had problems with their contractor, and many different problems to solve, but they finally got started on it, and they had the groundbreaking then in November of 1908, and we just celebrated last year on Thanksgiving Day. We celebrated the 100th anniversary of the groundbreaking for the cathedral. I think I'm going to stop right there with the groundbreaking and let Cora and Katie make any comments they wish to make.
Well, I think we need to add that these people that did all of the, what I went through, the hauling and the quarrying of the stone, was done when their farm work was done. Mm-hmm. They were all farmers, so they had to work all of their fields and do their farm work first. This was always done just in the winter time, quarrying the rock, because they were busy doing their own. So that's another reason it took so long to get all of that stone. That's why they started so much earlier. But yeah, they were in litigation for a whole year, where almost everything was at a standstill, through the architect that they had at the time, and then had to find another one, and then some revisions were made to the initial plans, and you know, no different than things are today. They were.
Mm-hmm. So they actually had to go to court with the first architect.
Yeah, yeah.
The church. Mm-hmm.
They did.
Was that here?
And so that laid up the process, the progress on dealing for a whole year. I mean, it was just at a standstill. So it was really only in 1909 where they really went back and started building, you know, and then mm-hmm. it was completed then by 1911.
Mm-hmm. Was it each family of the parish, or was it each person in the parish that had to donate, or carrying six wagon loads?
Every family was assessed for every child that they had, and you have to remember, these were large German families.
Yes.
There were many families with 11 to 15 mm-hmm. children. Every family who had had a child 12 years or older was assessed a wagon load, was assessed six wagon loads. So if they had six children, they were assessed 36 wagon loads of stone, plus $45 a year for each one of those. Now, it doesn't sound like much today, but it was
money.
A lot in the 1900s.
Katie, do you have anything you want to add to what we've said up to that point?
Well, I've heard that the men that were drilling the holes, they had calluses on their chests in doing that.
From leaning over on the brace,
yeah, they were
to drill it.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping Katie'd tell that story. She's told me that, and I wanted her to tell it because I thought that's so interesting, you know, that survived to this day. There's another legend, and I don't know what the truth is to this. Francis Shippers, who was gave tours of the cathedral for years here and was a historian of our church and really knew a lot about church history, always told in his tours that the mom and dad and all the kids would run out there to the quarries around Vincent out there, and they'd send the kids down to the creek to get buckets of water, to break through the ice and get buckets of water and pour the water in the holes instead of using feathers and let the freeze overnight and break that off. Now,
I've not heard that.
Yeah, I did.
That's
it would crack them.
Yeah,
that
I understand.
To crack it off. Well, I talked to Fritz Pete Felton, who you may know. He's an artist and a limestone sculptor, and really knows probably more about limestone than anybody any place. And And Pete says that's a myth, that wouldn't work, because he said the limestone is too porous and the water would have leaked out. But I've talked to some other people that swear that they did that, especially sometimes for fence posts, that they'd keep pouring water in those holes until finally it did freeze that loose. So whether that's just a story or not, it's kind of interesting to think about that they might have done some of that way. But you can actually, if you look carefully at the stones from which the church is constructed, you can see the marks of the feathers there in the drill holes too, where they actually used feathers to break most of that stone off.
Absolutely.
Well then, I'll continue a little bit here. After the groundbreaking in 1908, and when they had their contractual problem settled with the architect, by the way, the architect was John Combs, I believe was the gentleman's name. He was from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and they contracted him, and he designed several churches that they especially liked, that were the Romanesque style. And that was modified then by a gentleman by the name of Marshall from Topeka, because what Combs designed was really not the type of structure that would survive the harsh conditions here on the plains. And Marshall from Topeka knew what types of conditions we had here, and so he did redesign some of Combs' design. And it might be interesting for you to know we still have the original blueprints of the church here. Cora and a group of ladies encapsulated those and have them out flat now in drawers, so you can actually see the original blueprints of our church here, which is also kind of interesting. Another story I might tell you, this one is from my father-in-law. His father was born in Topeka in December of 1875 when they were on their way out here. And his father actually was one of the stone dressers on the church, actually did some of the work of dressing the stones. He was a farmer also, and they come in, like Core said, in the wintertime and when they could. A lot of times if they had old enough children, the children would do the farm work, and the men would come in here and give their labor to the church any time that they could. But my father-in-law was born in 1903, so when they completed the church, he's about 18 years old, and he went to school here in Victoria, and he was around the church probably more than he should have been, because they didn't like the kids to be around there. They were always afraid somebody would get hurt, and they didn't want anybody injured building the church. But my dad-in-law always told the story that they rigged up a two-platform hoist when they were building the steeples out there, when one platform was going to the top of the steeple as far as they were, the other one would be on the ground, and they'd load that. And that was by a system of pulleys and ropes, and they powered that with a horse. Well, my father-in-law told the story that horse wore a track down toward the southwest of where the steeples are that was about a foot deep. And that horse was so well trained, they'd just blow a whistle that it'd start, and they blew the whistle again and it'd stop. And it kept doing that. They always had a guide with it too, in case it didn't do that, but they used the same horse all the time for that, according to the story told me. The next big event in the construction of the church, which we just celebrated here on October the 4th, we celebrated the centennial of that event, that was the laying of the cornerstone. Mm-hmm. And the cornerstone is up, the bottom of it is probably a little over 6 feet off the ground, mm-hmm. and the cornerstone measures 3 feet by 4 feet by 3 feet. And it's a big piece of granite, mm-hmm. and we would like to remove the time capsule from it, but we don't know how to do that without making some permanent damage to the church, but we are almost certain that there is a time capsule in that. We know from the articles in the newspaper and some documents that we have that we don't know what's in it, but we would like to have that time capsule. We're still working on that at the present time. And they had a big celebration for the laying of the cornerstone on October the 4th of 1909. And they had, I don't know how many people here because the newspaper article didn't say, but Commissioner Joseph Goetz of the Ellis County Commission didn't go to the commission meeting that day. He wanted to come over here and be part of the celebration, so they postponed the county commission meeting till the next day. And I know that same newspaper article stated that the reason for building this huge church here was the fact that most of Herzog Township, if not all, was all Catholic, and met many of the surrounding people from the surrounding townships came to church here, and so they needed a building that would seat all the congregation that wanted to be at the services. This cathedral today seats about 1,100 people. So they went from a lean-to to a cathedral that seats 1,100 people. And I keep calling it the cathedral. Technically, it is not a cathedral because it is not the home church of a bishop. Mm-hmm. But William Jennings Bryan, when he came through here in 1912 on some of his presidential campaigns on the train, he stopped and looked at it and he said, "Indeed, this is a cathedral of the plains." And at that time, it was said to be the largest church west of the Mississippi River. So he was very impressed by it, and that name has kind of stuck, and it's still known as the Cathedral of the Plains. Well, I'll stop right there and let Cora and Katie say whatever they want to say.
Do you have any specific questions?
Not really. I actually left all my stuff at the house. I grabbed the wrong folder for a different class. So,
typical student.
I know. It's amazing I got out of here in one piece with all my clothes on. One thing I would like to talk about for each of you is how the church, growing up, or your time here, has influenced your life. Different, going to school here, or potluck dinners, anything, coming on and off the farm to go to church and to get baptized. Things like that, your personal experiences that aren't necessarily church history.
I remember when we came to church, we had to sit in front. They had pews in front where the kids sat, and then the nuns were behind them. That's what I remember.
Are the nuns still here?
No.
No.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They left.
Not enough of them anymore.
Maybe about 10 years ago, huh?
The
last one.
No, it's been longer than that.
Sister Mary Ryder was the last one.
It's been longer than 10 years ago.
Is it?
I moved here in 1970, and we still had one of the Sisters of St. Agnes was the principal of our elementary school at that time. And then we had three Sisters of St. Agnes teaching in the elementary school. There were no longer any sisters at the high school at that time. As the years went by, and I think it was probably by 1980, we didn't have any sisters left at all teaching in the school itself. We did still have usually one sister here that was in charge of our religion program, which was taught before the public school took up in the mornings at that time. And I remember the first contract I signed to teach here. It was in my contract that I would take my students to Mass every morning and teach 1 half-hour religion before our public school day started. That was in my contract. And that was true of all the teachers that taught here, whether you were of a religious order or not, whether you were a lay teacher or a religious teacher, you were expected to do that every day. And then as time went on, that all changed. And now it's pretty much like any other community, that although our elementary students in grades 1 through 5 still do have their religion program every morning before school takes up. So has been a change over the years. The Sisters of St. Agnes, though, were up until about 69 when unification kind of marked the end of that. Sisters doing most of the teaching here. They were responsible for a lot of the teaching in both the high school and the elementary school here in Victoria. And Cora and Katie were here. They can. Cora went to school, and she can probably tell you a lot more about that than I can.
My ancestors were also amongst the first, and my husband's ancestors were very instrumental in the building of the church itself. A lot of the first things that happened, his ancestors, his grandparents and great uncles were very instrumental. Actually, my grandfather and grandmother were married in this church. Mm-hmm. My parents were married in this church. I was married in this church, and our five children were married in this church. So we were all married, baptized, all of our the sacraments have all been received in this church for all of these people. My grandfather, they had 13 in their family, and all of their children are married in this church. So, you know, we have a generation, five, six generations that are have been here. I've lived here all of my life with the exception of 2 years. So we had... As what I can recall in my younger days, even going to church very, very young, the services were in German. The priest, the sermon was in German. I don't know if you're Catholic or not, mm-hmm. but the litany of the saints, everything they said was in German. And I know one of the funny things that I especially remember going to church with my grandma. Since you're Catholic, mm-hmm. you could relate to that. But you're not old enough.
I remember
enough.
Going to this church with my grandma.
So I went to church with my grandmother, and they were doing the litany of the saints, and of course they were responding, "Pray for us," and in German. And I still speak German today, but they say it so fast. And as a child, I kept thinking they were saying, "Don't fit me," and "Bitte für uns," and that "Pray for us," "Bitte für uns." And so I just kept saying, "Don't fit me, don't fit me, don't fit me." And my grandmother never caught on because she didn't speak English. So, you know, that's just one. After I got older and realized what the response was that they were saying, I said, "Oh my gosh, none of it fit me." So that was preschool for me, even. I can recall that. And of course, you didn't dare turn around, especially not if you were with grandma. You know, you didn't turn around to see who was in back of you, and you got a lot of pokes, and you certainly didn't doze off during the sermon either. And they were long back in the, and of course as a child they're probably long today for them as well. From there I started school, and as Ivan said, I had nuns completely all through grade school with the exception of fourth grade, and for some reason everyone seemed to have a lay teacher in fourth grade. A nun passed away, and so that fourth grade was left vacant, and they all never replaced that. And we always had lay teachers. My oldest brother, it was while he was in fourth grade that nun had passed away, and I can remember the very first teacher that they hired for that class was Esther Pfeiffer. That was Wilma Pfeiffer's older sister, and he was in the middle of that transition.
What year was that?
Oh, let's see, he was born in 34. He would have been 10, probably about 1944, 45, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. He'd have been about 10 years old in the fourth grade. But that was, and from that point on, they always had a lay teacher.
So from 44.
That's weird. Do you recall that? They just always, it was, the other classes had nuns. I had nuns throughout the whole grade, other than that fourth grade.
And what year did you start kindergarten?
No kindergarten back in my day. We were smart.
Oh well, that's right, I forget that.
We had no kindergarten. In fact, my oldest children didn't have, the two oldest children did not have kindergarten. The kindergarten did not start until Mark was born in 66. He was first class. And 5 years, 71.
Yeah, in the 70s.
Yeah, we didn't have kindergarten until in the 70s.
Until the 70s?
Uh-huh.
And so you said 69 was when that was unification, wasn't it?
Yes, So, and it was shortly after unification. And our first kindergarten here was not in our elementary building over here. The district bought a little house.
I was on the school board at the time. I wasn't on the school board. I initiated the kindergarten project in the community.
Right, but I know my son went to, he had all his elementary and high school education here. Mm-hmm. And when he started kindergarten, they were still having kindergarten up in that little house up there.
I was on the board when we sold and they moved.
Well, that's when we finally had room over here. You have to realize that at the time I started teaching here in 1970, it wasn't unusual to have one class. I had a class of seventh graders, I think was the largest class I ever had, was 56 students in one class. And I had all 56 of those in a reading class for an hour three times a week. There were only three of us that taught the seventh and eighth grade at that time, three. Lay teachers, and we had to divide things up and find out. We had our language class, we split the classes, and in our mathematics class we split the classes, in science class we split the classes, and then in all the rest of them, well, one of us would take the whole group so we could get every subject taught during the day. And so we had some interesting experiences, but that was the largest class, but it was not unusual at all to have 48 to 50 students per grade level at that time. We were bulging at the seams over here in this elementary building. We needed every foot of space we had, and there just wasn't room for a kindergarten over there at that time.
So I saw on the side of the building that one of the school over here across the street started in 1929.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The first part of the
parochial school. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And it was a parochial school until...
I don't know the year on that, Cora, because I know that it was public before unification for a while, but I don't know how.
It wasn't parochial anymore. Well, it had to have been when I started. Well, maybe not.
I don't see. I wasn't here at that time, so I can't help you with that.
I don't know.
And I haven't studied what year that they went from a parochial to a public school. The high school, I think did earlier than the elementary school did, because I know there was a separate school board for the elementary school and for the high school. They had two different boards of education for that, and they were under different administration entirely too. I don't know just when that year was either. I'd have to look that up someplace to see what that year was.
But they got their instructions in church in the mornings to kids before school. Father Ernest was here that year.
That's when I was married.
And the kids had their religion in church.
I was going to say we didn't when I was in school.
And then years ago,
that would have been in
Sunday
in the
afternoons.
50s already, the mid-50s.
From 1 till 1:30, they had instructions for the kids.
In what years was that, Katie?
In the 30s.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
I was going to say that would have been before my time, because I know we, from 1970 on, which I can speak with authority, we always had instructions in the school, actual classroom instruction. But up until about 1980, I think it was, we went to Mass. Before the Mass usually took, for depending on whether it was a special feast day, we usually got finished in a half hour, but not always. So your public school day didn't really always start at the same time, because you're obligated to have that half hour religious education first too.
Yeah.
We usually started Mass at 7:30, and then by 8 we'd have our religion instruction. By 8:30 we'd start our regular instructions. It's kind of the system.
Well, I started grade school in 41, 42. We had daily Mass all the time. Mm-hmm. Every morning. That's how you started your day. You went to daily Mass. Mm-hmm. then we'd go to the grade school, to the school, and we had nuns, of course, so we had religion almost continuously throughout the day, incorporated religion with math and everything else, too. However, we had one day a week where the priest would come into the classroom and have religion with us in place of the regular, it was a special, we'd have the pastor come in and have religion, and he did that with each class. At some point in time, so it was just a must. You went to mass every day, and I did that all through grade school and high school.
And that was, and the schools were public by that point.
Yes, they were public, and I have to say we had probably the most unusual situation here, and to this day do, of any school in the nation. We are so fortunate. We still have religion every day for our grade school kids. We have it before the public school day begins, but we have it in the public school, and the religion is now taught by lay people, with the exception of the fifth grade, which has our pastor comes in and he teaches fifth grade. And that is 4 days a week. Mondays through Thursdays, we have religious instruction in the classroom. On Fridays, they have choir practice. We have a youth choir, children's choir. That's very good, and they do their practicing and so forth on Fridays. So, yeah, we really don't like to publicize that because there's always somebody.
We'll take that part out of the interview. Okay.
But it is, you know, it's an unusual, we're blessed. We're blessed to have that situation here. The building for many years was owned by the district and was owned by the parish, excuse me. It was owned by the parish because it was built by the parish. But we leased the parish, then leased it to the public school to have when it went and then later on the district purchased the building from the school district.
When do you know that was?
From the church, excuse me, from the church, because the building was owned by the church.
Do you know when the church sold the buildings, the school buildings, to the district?
Must be in 86, 87.
Gosh. I think that would be about right, about 86, 1986 or 87. It was in the later
school board when the parish bought that building. Because I mean, when the school board bought the building.
Yes,
it was a song, $300,000.
Right, and just before that, they bought the the seminary over here from the captions too. They bought that just before they bought this building.
Yeah,
and that again was a bargain too, because it was, I think, $325,000 they gave for that one. It's used for the administrative offices and sixth, seventh, and eighth grades of middle school now.
Okay,
and so that the district actually owns three buildings now. But two of those were actually
the grade school belonged to the church here, and the other building belonged to the Cabochons.
Right. And that building was just sitting kind of vacant for many years. They did different things with it, used it for a renewal center and a conference center, but it was just kind of falling in disrepair because it wasn't used enough. And beautiful building.
It's still a beautiful
building.
Better built than what the grade school is.
Right, it is.
Very well built building.
Katie, you haven't talked much about your school. Did you? Because I remember my grandma, she went to school in Quinter or Collier. I can't remember, until she was in eighth grade. And she was born in 1917. So did you go to school all the way through high school? Or
I went to grade school.
Grade school? Did you come up to St. Fidelis to go to grade school?
I started in the third grade down, you know, at Victoria. And before that, I was at Walker.
In Walker?
I went to school at Walker.
And it was?
And I was confirmed down here. But I made my first communion at Walker, but I was baptized in Victoria.
What church is in Walker? St. Vincent?
St. Anne.
St. Anne.
St. Anne. Mm-hmm. Before we started the interview, you were talking about funerals. back in the old days, and how the family, the women, would wear black for 6 weeks.
6 weeks, yeah.
Could you talk about that some more? Or again?
But did you hear that?
Mm-mm. Go ahead.
No, when somebody died, like in a family, mm-hmm. they wore black for 6 weeks.
Just the women or the men too?
The women.
The women.
And I had an aunt that lived in Collier. And when my mother died, one of my other aunts came and told us she didn't even wear black for 6 weeks. Yeah. But
very disrespectful, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You said your mother passed away in 1938?
38, yeah.
How long did that tradition carry into later in the century? When did that start to fade out? Or?
Oh, I think when they start driving up to the cemetery. Remember, they used to walk to the cemetery all the time.
Well, I don't remember that, but...
And her grandfather would always lead the rosary, like on Old Souls
Oh,
Day.
Oh, yeah, I do remember him. Yeah. I don't remember him always
They would walk out to the cemetery, the whole parish.
They would carry Well, sometimes they'd take them on horse and buggy, wouldn't they? The coffins?
The coffins. Mm-hmm. They had a kind of a wagon with glass.
Stolterbogen.
And that's where they carried the person out to the cemetery like that.
It would be like a horse-drawn hearse. I've seen pictures of those in books as well as some movies. Mm-hmm. You know, the old Westerns used to have those in them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember my church in Wichita, St. Francis, St. Anne's, we would have potluck dinners. And my grandma always cooked for them, because apparently none of the other ladies could cook, so grandma had to show them how. And she always made noodles, or she brought... Or we came out here to Victoria or Hayes and bought noodles. Could you guys talk some about some of the dinners you guys have had in the past and how those were handled? Any food has effect, you know, that came about. That's brought over from Russia that you remember.
Well, we have our potluck for all the people that moved to our city that's going to come up November 1st.
Yeah. But I think you're more interested in the foods from years ago. Well, I remember when they had weddings, they would hire local cooks, you know. Many of them didn't. Mm-hmm. If they were relatives, they didn't even get paid. They just came in and cooked. And they'd cook 2 or 3 days ahead of time. So they had large weddings, huge weddings, you know, and they had 2 meals. Mm-hmm. And they'd come in the day before, and they would prepare all the roast beef, and they'd have noodles, and they would... Many years even prior to that, and I don't remember that, but my mother telling me they had what they call sour soup, which is a soup with a cream base, and it's basically sour cream, and it had little chunks of pork or beef in it. Correct me, Katie?
We never made that.
Oh, yeah. My mom used to say that. We used to call it Hochzeit soup, wedding soup. And they would make that ahead of time, you know, too. Now, in my day, I don't recall that at weddings, but my mother always told us about that that's what they had.
Is that similar to Gnebel soup?
I don't think it has dumplings.
It doesn't have dumplings in it. It has only this little bits of meat in it. Uh-huh. That's really, and it had a cream base on it, cream broth.
Okay.
So that was, but I can relate to my wedding, which would have been like in 1957. That probably seems like a long time ago to you. But, you know, again, the cook went in the day before, and they fried all of the chicken, and they made all of the roast beef, and the noodles, chicken and noodles, and the
Kalushkis,
right? Had kalushkis. You know what piggies in a blanket are? Kalushkis are meat cabbage rolls. They call them now. Sometimes they've gotten a lot of meat names for them.
People call them birox, don't they?
No. Birox is a different thing. These are little hamburger chunks of hamburger. They're about like so, and they're wrapped in cabbage and put in a roast, a large roaster with extra leaves of
rice in the
and it has rice along mixed along in with the meat, the hamburger mix. And then they're slowly baked in the oven, and there's some sauce that's sometimes put over them. And those are cabbage rolls. They had those for the weddings, and they had two weddings. I know we got a our wedding was on a Monday morning. Mass was at 9 o'clock. Of course, at that time you could not eat or drink anything before communion. You had a fast, so Mass was at 9 o'clock. We came back to my parents' home after Mass, had breakfast. Someone was there, the wedding party I'm talking about. Someone was there who had prepared breakfast at my parents' home for the wedding party. From there, we went to Hayes to a photographer in the studio and had our wedding pictures taken. We had a few pictures taken in the church, but it wasn't as common then yet as it, you know, as it is now. Wedding, most of the formal wedding pictures, they were all done at the studio. And then we came back to Victoria, and we had an all-day wedding, had a large dinner at noon, and then they'd clean up that and clean up the tables and push them back, and we would dance all afternoon until 5, 6, and there were singing groups here and there, you know, German, a lot of German songs then yet, they were still being sung, and the band would play until about 5 o'clock, and then we'd everybody would be fed again for supper with leftovers, or they'll add other things to it. And then we'd come back, and about 8:30 we started dancing again. We had a different band in the evening, and wedding march, and we'd dance until midnight.
Well, what about intermission?
Oh, intermission, yeah. We had half our intermission, and we'd have bologna sandwiches,
cake,
and dill pickles, and wedding cake, and you had to do that because sometimes some of them had too much happy juice, and in order to stay sober enough to drive home.
I've been to weddings like that.
Although they were near as astringent with the regulations then. Yeah. They could drive drunk better than what they can today.
Well, the cars didn't run as fast then either.
As you entered the wedding hall, people were bartenders, you might call them bartenders, certain people were designated to be back there with a little shot glass and the bottle, and everyone came in, got a straight shot of bourbon, or bourbon is basically what he was. There was not any choices there. And, you know,
and all afternoon the beer was
all afternoon, oh yeah, kegs and kegs of beer. It was served all day long. And there was, and in the evening too.
Yeah.
Wow.
Weddings all day.
Yeah.
And they didn't cost as much as they did now.
Well, in reality, yeah, they probably did. Then my parents tell me when they got married, they had weddings for 3 days, and the bride had 3 different dresses. They had a white one, a black one, and a pastel-colored one for each day. And they celebrated 3 days, and they fed their guests for 3 days like that. And they did the same dancing and merrymaking as we did for 1 day, but they had 3 day weddings.
How much would a wedding in the late 50s, about when you got married, how much were those?
Wish my dad was here.
He'd probably be able to remember. Just like that.
Gosh, I'm gonna just throw out a figure. $3,000-$4,000.
That was for a whole day worth of
food. Two full meals. I mean, big meals. There was, and the bands, and the musicians played the musicians.
And everything was split between the two parents.
Yes. The wedding, the cost of the wedding was always split by the two parties. In other words, my family and my husband's family.
Oh, so it wasn't just the bride's family.
Oh, no. It was always split. In fact, even all of my children, my own children, the two parties, we always split the cost of the wedding. It's not always and I don't know how many families do that yet in this area. I really don't know. I'm glad mine are all married.
You know, a couple things that we haven't talked about that I thought were interesting. Customs not being originally from this area. I know at our wedding, one of my wife's uncles stole one of her shoes.
They did that at my wedding too. I missed that.
And then this was after dinner in the evening. And they passed that shoe around, and everybody put some money in it. And then when he came and gave it back to her, and that was all for the bride and groom, you know, that whatever money they collected. And then another interesting custom, they did this at our wedding too, is everybody that danced with the bride would pin some money on her bride dress. Did they do that at yours too, Corey?
Similar. After the dinner at noon, we would, at that time, the old German custom of the Brautdusch, which is a beautiful German blessing mm-hmm. to the for the bride couple, the married couple. And we sang it in German. Now, in fact, I just sang it in Mercer Island last week for a wedding because my first cousin got married and she wanted this as part of the German tradition. We do have it now in German and an English translation so the young people can. But the lyrics are very beautiful and are actually a blessing to the bride and groom. So someone is designated to invite the guests up to the front and the band plays the music and someone is designated to lead them and everybody raises it's a toast to the bride and groom and they have their beer. That starts the afternoon right after the dinner and they sing that. And then from there they had what they called, well, the Brautreihe, it's like a march. The bride's kind of the bride's march. They'd have, and the bride would walk, even before that, and as soon as the dinner was over, someone, usually an uncle or a relative of the bride, was designated to steal the bride's shoe. And they had someone appointed as an auctioneer. And they would auction that shoe. I mean, it usually brought quite a bit of money. And the reward for buying this shoe, this man got to kiss the bride. So, you know, sometimes that shoe brought $200, which was quite a bit of money back in the 50s, you know. And they would just bid, the men would just bid on this shoe. And then whoever bought it, you know, got a kiss from the bride, they'd give the shoe back, and then they would do the bride's march, and they'd walk around the hall, and as they did that, people would come and pin money on the bride's dress, you know. Of course, it has to be paper money or it won't pin.
Yeah.
And they would pin all over her dress, and sometimes they'd pin some, the groom's family sometimes would pin some on the groom as well. And that was a tradition that was usually done back then, back in the 50s and probably some in the 60s. Occasionally, I think of the German side, if it's a German wedding from both sides, the Brautdusch, the German blessing, I know is sometimes done, yet usually at the request of a grandparent or something. You know, just the song itself is a lot of times still, if it's a German on both sides, or I don't know what the stipulations or requirements are for it, but occasionally you still have it done. Mm-hmm. So that usually started the afternoon, and then after that the dancing took place.
And they would get a blessing before they would leave for the wedding in the morning.
Yes.
The bride and groom would kneel, and the parents would give them the blessing.
Mm-hmm. At their home, before their Mass. Home. I just remember Mother putting out a white sheet on the floor, and my husband and I would kneel facing each other, and we'd take hands, and the parents would bless the bride and groom and have a blessing prayer at home before we went to church.
In our wedding, Alma, there is a picture of my wife receiving that blessing from her parents.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And it's just like you described it.
Uh-huh, yeah.
This is before the wedding mass.
The wedding mass.
The groom wasn't anywhere around at that time, but that the photographer came out the farm
taken. No, yeah. We had a picture, which is kind of faded, but
Jack Eakey took our pictures, and Jack came out the farm and took that picture, and it's just in with our other pictures in our wedding album.
And once in a while, I see, I have seen it done in church now already by the priest. I think it was Shanna and Kurt Dinkel, they had it done in church.
Mm-hmm. I don't believe I've ever seen it in church there, but I know that all Verda's sisters, you know, had that same blessing. That's an old German custom, wedding custom too. And you were asking about some of the potlucks and dinners we have. For all our celebrations, we usually have a meal with them of some kind. We just, on October 4th, I was telling you earlier, we had our our celebration of the centennial of the laying of the cornerstone. Mm-hmm. And after Mass and the blessing of the cornerstone, we adjourned to the cafeteria, and we had a soup and sandwich luncheon over there for that. And the soups we had, one of them is this area is really known for, is a green bean dumpling soup. And I think Coors recipe is the one we used to make that. And that was a big hit with a lot of the people who weren't from this area. I know we had the Sisters of Hope from Hope, Kansas came and performed for us for our entertainment for that event. And they emailed me that night for the recipe for that soup. They were going to have a soup supper and they wanted that soup. And then, of course, we also had chicken noodle soup, which is traditional too here. And then for those that didn't want any kind of German soup, we had some chili too for our soups for that. But well, then for our groundbreaking ceremony, we had a traditional Thanksgiving meal that was prepared by a lady that is from here, and she had a crew to prepare that, and we had a traditional Thanksgiving dinner for that. Had about 700 people here for that.
Oh,
so.
Turkey and dressing
and all the trimmings for that. That was really well prepared, and everybody really enjoyed
that.
We still,
you ask about funerals, we still, a parish here still prepares a dinner for the family that has a loved one pass away, the funeral dinner. We still do that, and it's not cold cuts, it's not. It is a five, we have meatballs, I have ham, mashed potatoes, gravy, a vegetable, salads, dessert, the whole thing. We do that. It's the Christian Mothers Society of our parish. We still do that. And we get comments from people that come from out of town that the food is just excellent and no one else does it. How can you do this? But it's something we've just never... Sometimes it's difficult to get enough help, but we still continue to do it. It's a service that is very much appreciated. Mm. And I've experienced it several times myself and my family, and it is a wonderful service that we provide.
And then we have the wake service.
Wake services,
yes,
yeah.
Different organizations, they pray.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we probably...
That's night before, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for the rosary then.
Mm-hmm. 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 And it hasn't been too long ago, I'm going to say... 3-4 years ago where we are not doing two night wakes anymore. You know, we always had wakes for two nights.
So
all
two
day
nights
and two
funeral.
Nights before the funeral, right. And it has been quite recently where they have gone to just one night before the funeral. I remember well the round the clock. Someone was there with the body at the funeral home of the family, 24 hours, and they had it for 3 days, right, Katie?
And before we had the funeral home, they had the bodies in the home or in the Knights home,
the KFC home.
Yeah.
So that's just been up until recently where they quit doing the
two or three.
I heard it's
mostly by the morticians don't
and
want to
I
do
heard
it
it's
anymore.
Cheaper if you only have one night.
Yeah, it is.
In
by
two
the morticians,
nights.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. For the family.
Yeah.
I think for about the last 10 years anyway, I don't remember any two night wakes. Before
once
that.
Once in a while, there was still. It hasn't been that long ago since I've.
See, that. I don't remember any in the last 10 years. There may have been some, but it's been rather recently.
Pretty recent, huh?
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you had anything else that we hadn't covered that you'd like to cover.
We covered much more than I could have even begun to ask, even if I had all my stuff with me. One thing I do want to talk about is the structure of the lay community in the church. I saw I looked your name up on Google, and you were you're the chairperson for the
Centennial Planning Committee. That's I'm the chairperson for that, and that's just a committee that got set up by Father Charles Polifka, whose brainchild this whole 2.5 year celebration was. My wife and I were just innocently out walking one morning, and Father Charles came, we were right over here by the school, and Father Charles came out. He said, I have something I want to ask you. And I said, well, Father, I said, what do you need? He said, I wondered if you'd agree to be on a committee to plan the celebration of the centennial of the building of the cathedral. And I said, well, I'd consider it. And we visited a little while and went on. Got a letter in the mail in a couple of days, and it said, thank you in advance for agreeing to serve on the committee.
That's how all of our letters
are. Yeah, and that's how Cora got a letter the same way. Anyway, Father Charles had picked a committee of people to serve on that, to plan the celebration of the building of the cathedral. And then that committee elected me the chairman, and I've tried to pass that job on several times without any luck, and that's how I got that particular position. But it's been interesting, and it's been a lot of fun, and I've learned a lot by doing it. You asked about the structure of our community here. The demographics of this community have changed greatly over the years, just since I've been here for almost 40 years now. Mm-hmm. When I moved here in 1970, you could count the number of non-Catholics in town on one hand. There just weren't any, and so that's why we didn't have any problem with our religion program. We didn't have to worry about what to do with the Protestant kids. But we probably have as many Protestants as Catholics living in town now, getting close anyway, because when you look at the kids that don't attend the religion program, there's almost as many kids not in the religion program as there are that are.
I'm still in fifth grade. I'm just thinking that's a small class. Of course, I've got 12 in there this year, which is really a small class.
How many of those do you have in your out of the whole fifth grade? You have 12 in the religion, and there are 28 fifth graders.
Are there 28?
Yeah, there's four. They have two classes of 14,
really?
I think.
No, I think the fifth grade is only one class this year. This is a small class.
I thought it was two classes.
I know
of
it's got to be more than 12, and you may be right. Yeah. You know,
I don't have any exact. You know, I haven't counted to back that up. I'm just guessing at that. But it's a big change.
Right. It's an interesting question. I'm going to find out. But I think that's
the
Ivan is probably right on.
There are more and more people are moving in who are not of the Catholic faith. It isn't like it once was, where it's almost 100%.
And we have no other church in this community. No.
So it's still St. Vitale's is the only church in Victoria.
Right.
Yes,
uh-huh.
It is the only church.
Mm-hmm. We can't say it's the only church that's ever been here, because there used to be down south when the Englishmen were down there. The Episcopal Church was down there.
Yeah.
And I guess that building what I read, it was torn down, and they built the Presbyterian Church, that old one in Hayes, out of the stone, out of that.
That's right.
And it's still there at the museum in Hayes. So that's the only other church that I know of that's ever been in Victoria from the history.
Based on the changes that are coming down the pike that I heard on the news just last night, we're going to get some of those Episcopalian priests in our...
Yes.
So.
I heard that.
Yes, yesterday too.
Well, what goes around comes around. That's how they started out. It had been old for old Henry VIII, that they'd probably still be Catholics.
Yeah, and that's, as Ivan had said, how we all get in. There were, I don't know how many couples that we started. The Father, he always liked to have couples working together, which is good, but it has its drawbacks too, because... there's family involved, and it's difficult for young families to be at everything together. So, you know, but it's got its pluses.
It's
so
six couples.
There were six couples that initially were on the committee, and how we got into the history of it was probably because of my husband. He always enjoyed history and was very interested. He says, Cora, that would be fun. But my husband was ill then already, and he passed away 2 years ago, so I'm stuck with it now.
But
I've talked to him a lot of times, sometimes not kind words either.
You still can't get out of it, can you?
No.
But her husband, Benny, also did before he passed away, compiled a list of all the old German songs that they used to sing and made a notebook of those, and he arranged a lot of those for four voices. When the church originally had a choir, it was an all-men's choir. They didn't have any women in the choir. And that wasn't allowed. they just had a men's choir. And so music that they sang at that time was arranged for four male voices.
It was mostly Latin and German.
Yeah, in Latin and German. And Benny, a very talented musician, arranged much of that music. We have a whole notebook full of it that he did, fortunately, so that it's for regular choir voices, soprano, alto, tenor, and bass, and he made some very beautiful arrangements, and we use that in a lot of our celebrations. We particularly like to go back to the old music and sing the old songs.
So you guys still sing the old German songs?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. We do.
We have some choir arrangements yet that are German, particularly at Christmas, O du Eine, several, and of course Silent Night in German, and some of the old Christmas carols we still do in German. Our Christmas Mass is becoming more and more traditional. Yeah, we usually do a Latin Mass, sing a Latin Mass for the Midnight Mass at Christmas time. Victoria's got a lot of musical talent here. We have an excellent choir. In fact, we have, as small as we are, we have four choirs. We have the adult choir, which we call the cathedral choir now. We have a children's choir. We have a youth choir.
And then we have
some group
our centennial choir.
And the centennial choir. What about the Schmidtbergers? Yeah, and I was going to say, we've got some really talented smaller groups, ensemble groups. We've got two men's groups.
Got the trilogy.
Trilogy, and we've got the, what's that quartet called?
Yeah, Four Star.
Four Star.
And then there's the Nostalgics.
The Nostalgics, which is a girls' women's trio.
Chorus. Oldest daughter is the director of our cathedral choir over here now. Her husband used to direct that choir for many, many years. Benny directed the choir. And Kathy is a choir director, band director out of TMP Marion, and she comes over here on Wednesday nights and directs our adult choir over here.
And we missed you last night.
Yes, you did, didn't you?
You haven't talked about sweet and sauerkraut. You can't forget that.
No, but it doesn't really relate to the church, per se.
That's okay.
Oh, it's okay? Yep,
that's okay.
Well, we had, actually, this started probably back in 71. It went on for 10 years, and it was a community variety show. A lot of music. It was comedy, and it was strictly adults. You had to be 18 or over to be in it, and it was directed by local people. There were the Billinger brothers, very, very talented, and they wrote everything was original. All of the comedy, all of the skits, all of the little acts, everything was original. That they wrote it all. As years went on, some of the others got the knack of it, and a few others added. My husband did all of the arranging. We always had a live pit band and good musicians, and the big band sound, big band music sound, and pit band accompanied the choirs that sang, the groups that sang. He wrote all of the special arrangements for all of that, and it was originated strictly as a fundraising activity
for
charity. It didn't matter. Some was given to the church, some was given to the school, it was given to people that were needy. One year, right prior to that, or during the time we were doing the show, usually had anywhere from 3 to 5 performances over a weekend. Sometimes we would have maybe 3 one weekend and then 2 the following weekend. In the high school auditorium, which was packed for time they showed it, every performance. I know one year there was a family's home burned down during that period, and we gave that family, it was Eddie Brungart from Walker, we gave that family a nice donation to get started on. So it went to various things, and it went on every year. I think it was 81 or 82, and then a couple of years we did a Christmas show in addition to that. It was just a lot of work and very time consuming, but you know, eventually people just didn't have time for it, and unfortunately, and stopped it. And then we had a little rest, and then they came back and they did another one, and it was a few years, I'm going to say maybe 5 years later. There's been talk that perhaps they might try to do something for our final celebration, but we haven't, I don't know how that is materializing.
I haven't talked to Wayne and Rich lately about that, but they're still kind of planning.
That would be nice.
Yeah, it was well known. I mean,
they came from all over the people, too.
Well, Hayes, basically. Yeah. We didn't came. Oh, you mean the people that attended? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. They came from.
They even took it out to Denver, didn't
you? Yeah, they performed. We took the show on the road 1 year.
What was this called again?
Sweet and Sauerkraut.
Sweet and Sauerkraut.
For a long time, people thought it was something to eat.
Well, that's what I first thought when Katie brought it up.
But that's just the name to identify who was doing it. That, and there were some acts had actual German in it, you know. We had one, in fact, she works here at the parish office. She's probably here right now. She can do some of her acts in German, Norma Burns. And there were some German lines in it, you know, that a lot of the older people understood. The younger ones didn't, but the way they were performed, they were funny. There was good comedy.
Now, you keep bringing up German. My grandparents and great-grandparents all spoke Low German.
Uh-huh.
Is that all the German that you're referring to? Is that all Low German?
Yes. The High German was...
Walker people.
Yeah,
and they came from a different part of Germany.
They came from Lower... My husband's parents, my father-in-law spoke the High German. It was hard. It's hard for me to understand. But his mother spoke the Low. I didn't call it Low German. Mm-hmm. I guess it was
German
for matters of identifying the Volga Germans, mm-hmm. Right? So the family. Then there were nine children in that family. The family spoke more of the Low German than of the High German, probably because the mother had, when they were young, you know, initiated probably most of the of the conversation. But the father, my husband, did know some High German because he would repeat some of the things that he heard his father saying.
But you know, Cora, I know just from being here, every little village kind of had their own dialect too, mm-hmm. because as I've sung with different choirs, they always get arguments. Well, that's not how we said it in Munger.
Yeah,
but this is the way we said it in Vincent. You know,
and Herzl.
Yeah, and every little village had their own.
They had their own.
No, Catherine Munger, Piper. They were all different.
Oh yeah, yeah. They were. Uh-huh. Well, they came from their own little settlements in Germany, mm-hmm. and then they migrated to Russia, mm-hmm. and when they created their little settlements in Russia, they called it the same name as that they had in Germany. When mm-hmm. they came to America, it was the same thing. You know, however, by the time they got to America, they started melding with each other more. Mm-hmm. Where in Germany and in Russia, they were really pretty isolated. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would stick together. Mm-hmm. And that is why when my husband's father and mother married, they considered there is a mixed marriage because she was Volga German and he was High German. You just didn't do that back then.
His family was actually came over from Germany.
His mother, they both are from Germany. My husband's mm-hmm. parents, they're both from Germany, but his father came from Northern Germany, what they called High German,
okay.
And the mother was from the Bavarian area, that the rest of them came, that migrated from Germany to Russia by means of the Volga River, mm-hmm. and then from Russia to America, mm-hmm. and they called them Volga Germans. So they were the Low Germans. But then when they came over here, they were married in this country. He married this this woman from the Low Germans, and they considered it a mixed marriage.
Well, you know, even my wife's parents, my wife's father was from Victoria here, mm-hmm. and her mother was from Catherine.
Oh my!
And those, there wasn't any blood loss between those two. Uh-huh. When they got married, that was considered all. Uh-huh. Her parents were against.
Oh, Parker that Loretta marriage. Was like that too. They were really bad.
Yeah, it wasn't good to be from another little village. Mm-hmm. You should marry your own kind. Yes, but things changed over the years. But I know, and even the cooking. I know my wife will say, "Well, this is Catherine cooking. You know how her mother cooked, and they don't do it this way in Victoria." She, mm-hmm. you know, she'll talk about different things that we have because I like all this German food, mm-hmm. and she says, "Well, this is the way Mom fixes it. That's the way the Catherine people cooked." And so
you said something about Gnebel before, I think, didn't you say? Did you say Gnebel or did you say dumplings?
Gnebel.
Yeah. I made a great big roaster of cream and potato Gnebel yesterday for Good Samaritan Home in Ellis today. That's reminded me of Gnebel. But yeah, Gnebel's a, you know, I still like Gnebel. My kids all like Gnebel.
Yeah, Munger, I think called
Glaze. My dad's family mother's family called it Glace, and my dad's family called it Gnebel. And they were not a mixed marriage. They were both from different communities called the same thing. And each had their own individual recipes, too. They weren't all made the same.
Well, when you look in our cookbook over there, you know, you can see the different areas, recipes in that. Our Towers of Faith and Courage cookbook.
So you say your mother came from Quinner or Collier?
My mom's mother grew up.
Okay.
Outside, it was Collier or Quinner. I can't remember which.
What was your grandmother's maiden name?
Brown.
Brown?
Brown.
You're kidding.
No.
B-R-A-U-N.
Well, it when they came over, it was Braun, and then they changed it to, I don't remember when they changed it to Brown, but it was Helen and Andrew Brown.
Okay. It's probably my great uncle. my maiden
don't
name.
Don't you remember Helen and... What was his name?
Helen and Andrew.
Andrew. They moved in from Collier.
That was my great grandparents.
Yeah.
They live on Ferns Street.
They live here in Victoria.
Larry Burns' wife, Joan.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they did change their. Did they change their name?
It wasn't Brown. It's Brown.
It's B-R-A-U-N is Brown.
Yes, but they changed it. It's Brown to Brown, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah, now there were some others. There were some in the same family. One one brother had B-R-O-W in their name, and the other brother had B-R-A-U-N.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's still that way. There's, I know one of my wife's uncles was Sally Brown. You know,
yeah, I know Sally. He changed his.
His B-R-O-W-N, you know, mm-hmm. but he was really B-R-A-U-N originally. Mm-hmm. That a lot of that, I think, happened during World War II, because it was not a good thing to be German during World
War
II.
Well, and Brown was Hitler's wife's last name.
Yeah, and so
Eva Brown.
You know, I remember my parents are both German too, not from this area, but they're both German. Mm-hmm. And they talked German at home all the time, but they didn't ever teach it to any of the children because we weren't to speak that at school because it...
Well, they got punished.
Yeah.
We weren't allowed to speak German.
In school.
On recess.
No,
got punished.
It wasn't the thing to do.
Yeah. The nuns, they weren't allowed to speak. Even when my husband started school, and that was another generation from Katie's. Mm-hmm. But he said, well, and my older brother. Now, I don't remember so much of it, of being, but I think we didn't speak much German.
Now, one of Betty Schmidberger's grandsons.
Who?
Betty Schmidberger.
Okay.
Her grandson, I think, teaches in Lawrence.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And every so often when he's out here, he comes over and wants to know about German. He writes everything. He asks what, you know, like a table, what we call it, you know, then he writes it in English first and then in German. I've done that several times for him already whenever he comes.
What's his, you know what his name is? His last name?
Schmidberger?
No, Tappen.
but
oh, it's his one of
Betty's daughter's sons.
Betty's daughter's sons. Okay.
I think his dad passed away.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Tappan. T-A-P-A-N.
Yeah.
Tappan. Mm-hmm. Because his dad is buried up here.
And he's from the cemetery. Lawrence.
Mm-hmm. Probably a student at KU.
Well, that's what I was curious about, if he was a professor, if he was a student.
By the way,
you know him?
The Brown family and I are a different Brown family. We are not related.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fine.
But I have an uncle that would be I had an uncle who would be a brother to your grandfather.
Great-grandpa?
Uh-huh. Or your great-grandpa.
We probably went to your family.
Had married my mother's sister, so he became my uncle, but there was no blood relation.
See, that was Andrew's brother,
mm-hmm. Adam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Nick Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Brown wasn't a brother, though.
Mm-mm, Nick,
he was the first
remember.
Cousin. Okay. That was Silly Brown's dad.
The Brown from Vincent down here was a brother to Adam.
What was his name?
I can't think of his name.
Wendland?
Not Wendland.
His dad.
There was another Brown. Dan Brown was a brother to Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And life goes on.
Yeah.
Is there anything else we could
help
you with, Jeff? Or is this, or you think you have enough now?
I think this is plenty. I'd love to stay and talk for a while, though, after the interview's over, if you guys don't have anything to do.
Don't have anything I have to do. I don't know about this.
When I went to school here, we had only one family that wasn't Catholic. The rest was all Catholic.
Uh-huh. I think that was the case when I went to school.
He was the mail carrier's son.
Oh, Crawford's was the only non-Catholic family in school as long as I was here.
That was Shook.
Oh, yes, I remember him.
Mm-hmm. And when the priests come in school, the nuns would give him some homework to do while the priest had his religion with us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Crawford's that were here, that whole family is Catholic now. Teddy Crawford and his whole family, they're all Catholic.
Jeff.
Their kids all went to school here. But I think they all went to religion classes, too. They didn't go to attend Mass, but they were in class when during religion class.
Well,
now,
I know.
Now, Jeff, did he join the church?
Oh, they're all Catholic.
Uh-huh. But I know his wife was Catholic.
Oh, but they're all, the boys are, they're all, even the parents are Catholic now in Hayes. Ted Crawford married him, and he's a father is a...
You know, a lot of the students that were not Catholic when I was teaching over here would attend the religion program anyway because mm-hmm. they didn't really have anything else to do and they just didn't want to be babysat in the cafeteria or the gym. So their parents would allow them to mm-hmm. attend the religion program anyway. I know I had some in class that really weren't Catholics, but we taught the religion just the same to them as we did to our Catholic students.
My husband's grandfather built, were you in our church?
Mm-hmm.
Built the two altars on either side of the main altar.
The transept. Mm-hmm.
He did that. And if you saw in the back of church, in the vestibule in the back, as you go to the two restrooms,
mm-hmm.
there was this frame, had a hammer.
Ah,
that's my husband's grandfather.
Oh, okay.
So he was one of the stone masons, but he was also a very good carpenter. And there's a story about him, and I always thought it was just fiction and Francis told, but his family, I've asked Benny's sister, his oldest sister, and then he says, no, it's really true. He was up quite high, and he was in as they were building the church, and he fell about 30 feet down to the next level. And, you know, people gathered around. They thought he was... And his brothers were also very, very instrumental. They were, in fact, one of his brothers was the very first organist here in church, too. And they thought, and he got up and he was not harmed. And in thanksgiving to God for sparing him, he promised he was going to build those two altars in church.
And that's how the church got those two.
Well, that's how he built. But he did a lot of other things too.
What's more amazing about that, as I understand, he built those all out of scrap lumber.
Yeah.
He didn't use any new lumber in those. He used all scrap lumber from the forms and things that were left over after the church was finished to build those two altars. And if you look at those, that's amazing.
And it's all, no, there are no power tools. You're not thinking power tools. That was in
1916, I think we got the power, didn't we?
Yeah.
Those altars, I don't know just what, but he built those after the church was completed, I know.
Yeah, maybe it was even 19, yeah, it was after, because they were, the other two altars were in the third church.
Right.
But and not the, those two.
And the high altar
Saint
was
Joseph
in.
St. Joseph and... what's the other one? Can't think of the name.
Anthony? No.
No, no. On the north side. Blessed Mother. Where she's holding Jesus.
Oh, the Sorrowful Mother.
Sorrowful Mother.
And St. Joseph.
Yeah, those were in the third church. They were moved over. Uh-huh. And then the other two altars were built after, you know, for this church. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was quite a man. He did... did a lot.
It's amazing that they could do that type of work with just hand tools. Mm-hmm. If you look at the stone, the masonry work on the church too, when you look at the, for example, those splash guards there, they're just one just like the other, and those are all hand carved here on site. They didn't have any power tools to do that with. They did that with chisels and hammers.
And the capitals on top of the pillars?
Yes.
12 of those capitals?
The granite pillars.
The capitals clear up on top.
Yeah.
And if you look, there's angels up in front in the capitals, four of them on each corner. Mm-hmm. And the pillars, the corners, there's one, it's got apples. Mm-hmm.
There's only two that are alive.
And there's another one. It's got the face of a lamb. Mm-hmm. If you really look at it, and then there's another one. The face. It's not. I said it might be the devil. You know, it's
like they have over in the cathedrals in Europe, a gargoyle they call them. Those were actually to scare the evil spirits away. I think is what. Had those there. But the gentleman, I've never found the name of the person that carved those capitals on all those pillars.
You're going to ask that?
He just came here and carved all those, and they said that they didn't even pay him very much.
He left.
Yeah.
No one knew what his name was, and he had them all carved except two.
Yeah.
And then Benny's grandfather carved those two, and they were the ones farthest in the front.
They said what he was most, that legend is, what he was most interested in, they had to furnish him a pint of liquor a day. I don't know whether that was true or not.
I didn't hear
that's
that.
That's what they always said.
They said it took a month to make one of them.
Yeah, it took him about a month, they said, to make those. So he was here. He was here a good period of time, because there's 14 of those pillars, and then there's capitals on some of those other false pillars, too. Mm-hmm. So they...
Now you didn't tell him about the pillars, how they came. And
no, I didn't tell him about those,
tell
Katie.
Him about
well,
that one.
Those granite pillars over there, those are I think 10 feet 10 inches tall, and they finally weighed one because they first of all they wondered how they were going to get those from the railroad. Those are from Vermont. They're Vermont granite. And they hauled them in here on the railroad, and so they had a problem to get those up there. So, well, I thought they'd take three new grain wagons and take the boxes off of those and load them on that. That'd surely care. They crushed a grain wagon with those, so no, that wasn't going to work. So they figured out they'd take a thrashing machine, and they took the works off a thrashing machine and used the undercarriage of that, and the blacksmiths modified it, and they pulled it up here. Father-in-law always told me, he said they used a span of six horses to pull each column up here. And so they renovated over the grain scale they had. They had a scale here. They weighed 8,500 pounds apiece. That's why they crushed those wagons. And then it took 40 men. Some of them would go behind with pikes, you know, and push, and the others would pull on ropes and with blocks and tackles and pikes. They rolled those in on special tracks they built out of wood to where they were to be set up. And then at the quarry, they carved special holes in those that would hold a jig there that would lock into place, that they could set them up. And they said it took 40 men using block and tackle to set those up in place on the bases. Those bases are Bedford limestone from Indiana, as the capitals are too. Those are all imported from Indiana. And I understand that the only thing that was not done on site here were those pillars. Those were all at the quarry. Those were all finished at the quarry and polished at the quarry and came in here like that.
So are the pillars in the church one piece each, or are they several pieces?
No, that's just that 10 feet 10 inches is
that's
one piece.
One section.
All one section. That's all solid granite. And they weigh 8,500 pounds, so when the weight was anyway. And I'd like to know the answer to this, but I don't. There are eight of those that are cylinders, and there are six of them that are octagons, octagonal prisms. And why they did that, I don't know. The ones in front are the octagonal ones, you know, then further back. I don't know whether they got mixed up or
decorative, I don't know.
You know, I'd like to know the answer to that, but I've never found it in any of the reading why that would be that way.
I have some notes here that I found in some of the history stuff, and it was by Father Jordan. And you just mentioned this with the whiskey. I want to read what he's got on here. He says, capitals, the artist, then he has a note. All he came with was a chisel and a hammer and a bottle of whiskey. And he says to Father, if I had two, I could still do a better job.
Well,
so your story, yeah, I had these little, and I found it in those notes that Father Jordan used when he gave the tours of the church.
Tours of the church.
Just to
all that's precious.
And that's what he has on here. He says, capitals. The artist had a chisel and a hammer and a bottle of whiskey. And then he says, Father, and if I had two, I could do a still better job.
Yeah, the story goes, you know, that they'd just bring him a pint every day, and that he'd go to work, and that's what he wanted. For
maybe that's the reason.
Maybe they missed a day, and he says, I'm leaving, huh? Yeah. He took off, and he didn't even get paid for his work, as far as we know.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's one of those stories you just wonder about, you know. Why he came here.
And he was here a month for each of those pillars, and then if it took him that long, you know, what did he live on during that time?
Of course,
whiskey.
somebody probably took care of him if he was doing that for the church, you know, had him live in their home. But that's just a lot of
paid
that.
Him, you know, as he finished a pillar or so, or who knows, you know.
Father Jordan, I had the privilege of knowing him a little bit when I first moved here. He was still alive, but he was getting along in years, had a big, long, white beard, and he talked with a very heavy German accent. I could understand him because he sounded like my grandpa. But I like to listen to him talk. He loved to talk. He'd just tell you a story.
Oh, yeah. Benny's favorite story, my husband's favorite story. And he taught music. He was a music teacher up here at the high school. And he always liked bringing his band down to get the picture taken in front of the church. And he had this group down here. And Jordan insisted on giving him a tour of the church. And Benny was trying to get him back to class, and the kids just loved it because they didn't want to go back to class. And he had all these band kids in their band uniforms. You know, they were dressed in full. And he thought there was a tour group. So he just kept talking and talking to him. He says, I had a heck of a time getting him back to school. I said, I finally just left him here. But Jordan was giving him a tour of the church. That was in the early 60s.
He was an interesting priest.
Well, I don't have any more questions.
I hope we've given you what you needed, Jeff, since you made the trip out here. It's been interesting to kind of talk about the church and the things that have happened here. Katie, do you have anything more you wanted to add? And you have a lot of interesting little stories.
A lot of interesting.
Yeah. Okay.
but
Katie just found some of the old collection baskets that she...
Did you see those?
No, but you know, when you were talking about the pulleys before, I want to tell you that we have one here that's the original.
Right.
Down in the basement of the
church. Joe Brungart was telling me about that. That was used to build the church with one of the pulleys.
Yeah, we had two of those pulleys. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he brought one up to show it one morning after 6:45 Mass.
And we've got three collection baskets.
Yeah, Katie showed me those. In fact, I have those at home. They're walnut.
Case.
And the old-time collection baskets. Do you remember those?
I don't know. I'd have to see them.
They were full of pennies all the time when they come around.
Kind of prime pump there.
Katie said they had handles on them, but now they're just collection plates. Somebody sawed the handles off of them.
Aww. You know, I bet I know where the handles are.
Where are they?
You know, the lighters
to
light the candles?
Uh-huh.
They've got handles on about this long. I bet they cut them off and put them on that the lighter.
The candle.
You just look at them.
Yeah.
And they've got a real nice design on.
Uh-huh.
When you come to church, you just look at them once.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. But I wonder how long those handles were on there. Were they
probably like our collection baskets in back?
But they may have cut those up, but they were just sawed off and sanded down there. So what Katie had me take them home, I'm going to take them down to one of our craftsmen and see if they can make new handles on them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can use them in our final celebration.
Yeah.
Take a collection.
Nice. Take it.
And they have, a couple of them have green felt in the bottom of them.
Okay, I remember the green felt.
Verta's going to put some new, one of them doesn't have it in there anymore. Verta's going to get some new green felt and put new green felt in the bottom of it. So, anyway.
But if he makes the handles for it, maybe he could get the design on.
Right. Right.
Maybe you could take one of them along.
Yeah, I can take. I'll.
And they're the color of the basket.
Yeah, I know. I think they're made out of walnut. You know, they're turned out.
A walnut, I think.
I think that's what they are. They'll know for sure. You know, whoever I get to do it. Katie mentioned Berlin Hammerschmidt probably do it. Yeah, we have a lot of good craftsmen here in town. Still can do a lot of that. A lot of those things.
Well, he's got a cabinet up at his farm that was built by Benny's grandfather in 1904. It's got a date in there. And it had to have been made for the monastery because the church wasn't here then yet.
Mm-hmm.
So the Capuchins came before, at least this church.
They were here in 1877. The monastery was built before the church was.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Church has never had anything but a Capuchin priest.
Uh-huh.
The Capuchins have always been pastors of this church.
Okay, because I didn't know the Capuchins came over and started here.
They never left when the Capuchins came. They've been here ever since. They were over.
Yeah, they weren't here all the time to start with. You know,
it was only like maybe 6 months or 8 months. It was, you know, when they first came in 1876, they had a priest from Salina that traveled through and visited like maybe once a month.
Yeah.
And this went on.
A circuit rider, they called him, I think.
It went on for a while, and he wasn't a German-speaking priest either.
No, and they had problems because they couldn't really communicate.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's when the bishop decided they needed to get the Capuchins because they had some good Germans that could communicate with the people here.
Yeah, they were the driving force, definitely. Yeah, the third church was built primarily through the skill and architectural ability of the pastor that was here at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, he was the one that got the ball rolling on.
Uh-huh.
What was his name, Mueller?
Is
that right? Mm-hmm. Father Mueller, I think.
I
think that's right.
Jerome. Father Mueller was the one that was here for this church.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, but the one that was, I might no, there was a different, for the third church, I knew that he was.
Oh, for the third church.
For the third church.
Wasn't it Jerome for this church?
Yeah, Jerome Mueller.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Yeah
for this
was
one, that's the one I was
one.
Thinking of, mm-hmm. that you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Did you get to see our centennial calendar, Jeff, that we did for our celebration?
I did not.
Oh.
You might like to just look at that. this is